Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and this is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review with Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when you're interested in listening to it, because that's when you'll click on it. Today, we've got a second appearance on ESI Bytes from Brett Burney from Burney Consultants. He's joining us on the show to talk about how you shop for electronic discovery services. And Brett is a consultant with Burney Consultants, which was founded by him to provide professional consulting services to corporate executives and legal professionals. Prior to establishing Burney Consultants, Brett Burney spent 5 years at the law firm of Thompson Hine in Cleveland, Ohio, where he worked extensively with litigation teams and building electronic document databases, counseling on electronic discovery issues, and managing the technical responsibilities of presenting electronic evidence at trial. Brett was responsible for several other projects at the law firm, including document automation and the wireless email system. He's a featured speaker at numerous legal technology conferences, including the ABA Tech Show, American Lawyer Media Legal Tech Shows, the International Legal Technology Association. Lots of articles. Brett, great to have you back.
Carl, it is great to be back. Thank you very much.
And this is sort of like going to the supermarket, right, Brett? You just put your shopping list together. At the end of this show, we're going to have all the people that want to buy eDiscovery services taught how to put their shopping list together.
I would love to think that it's that easy. There is a lot of work. I guess it would be like going to the store with your shopping list if you spent maybe, you know, half an hour doing your research before you went there. There's a lot that goes into a lot of this, as you and I were discussing as we go through our little outline here.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know if we have a coupon mailer that goes out, but anyway.
We'll have a coupon code for people to use later on.
Okay. Well, let's first start off. What stages or phases of e-discovery can be quantified with a cost?
Well, that's always the best question, right? If we think about the electronic discovery reference model, the EDRM, you know, it's always kind of a moving target a lot of times with the cost. And of course, in order to put a cost on something, it has to be quantifiable, at least when we're talking about electronic discovery these days, because every litigation matter is going to be different. And every time that we go through talking about the collection of ESI and then there's subsequent review and the production of ESI, there's different stages in there that some are easier to quantify, at least to slap an actual cost on, than other stages. I would say probably, you know, the most notably is the processing stage, the review stage, and then the production stage, because those have really kind of more of a per unit cost that can be associated with them. With the processing and usually with the production, it's either a per gigabyte or a per page processing fee that you're going to be charged for tipping the files, for example. And then with review, historically it has been a per hour billable charge, right? A lot of times it's attorneys and lawyers that are going through each document one by one, and then they are looking at them, and of course, historically, that has always been by the billable hour.
Yeah, I built a software package called StaffWrite back in 2002 for some large projects that I was in, and a former Altman Weil consultant helped me put some of the data together. And I actually went to StaffWrite again today to do an analysis. So, you know, these things haven't changed that much in some of the areas that you can quantify cost. What are the biggest costs in e-discovery?
Historically, that has always been the review stage. You know, depending on who you talk to, the review costs can go anywhere from 50% to 90% of the total cost of a litigation matter. And again, it just always depends on who you talk to and the type of litigation a lot of times that goes on. I was fortunate enough a couple of years ago, I wrote an article for law.com on the document review cost. And I was talking to my good friend Tom O'Connor, who many listeners I know will recognize the name. And he attributes the fact that the highest cost being the review cost in an e-discovery matter is directly attributable attributable to that hourly billable rate. And to hear Tom talk about it, of course, it's just that antiquated concept, I think is the phrase that he used that I included in my law.com article. It's this concept that, of course, lawyers are wedded to. Number one, that you have to look at every single document. And we'll save that argument maybe for, you know, an FRE 502 discussion later on down the road. But the thinking is that you still have to look at every single document. And if you have to look at every single document, that takes time, right? So, Carl, I mean, that's what the lawyers do, and that's what they would continue to do, is that if you're going to take time to look at that document, then we're going to charge a billable rate for that, an hourly billable rate. Now, of course, there's all kinds of rumblings in the industry, as there have been for several years now, that perhaps we should look at different ways to charge that out or different ways to charge the time. But, you know, history is a very powerful force, and so I think we'll see the hourly billable rate stay around for a while. Hopefully, in the next few years, we will see some innovation in this aspect, both from, I think, the law firms and, of course, coming from some of the vendors.
Yeah, and you mentioned the difficulty of putting eyeballs on every document. Well, Judge Grimm did a real nice podcast with us on different types of review tools that might be coming down the pike, and you know whether there's an appetite for accepting that you can't put eyeballs on every document. And he was very much an advocate that you can't. The other reason I wanted to mention that is you mentioned 502. We're doing a podcast with him in about 2 weeks again, Judge Grimm and Tom Allman, to talk about 502.
Well, I've heard that Judge Grimm's podcast earlier, and that is a fantastic podcast. Of course, Judge Grimm being the author of the Hobson Opinion, as well as one of the major forces with the new Federal Rules of Evidence 502. And I'll just a quick anecdote. I was at the Masters Conference last year in D.C., and, of course, another one's coming up again in October. Judge Grimm was there, along with Judge Facciola, I might add, and Judge Hedges as well. But it just was burned in my mind. Judge Grimm and Judge Facciola were at the front, and they were on a panel, and they just said, how many people here in this room, and of course it was all lawyers, still believe that they have to look at every single document? And, of course, the entire room, save for maybe 0.05%, raised their hand because everybody did. And I'll never forget, Judge Grimm just looked at the room, and he said, why? Why do you think that that is still so important? And then we have some subsequent discussion after that. But that just shows that he has such a strong belief in the fact that there are better ways to go through this. And, of course, you know, he's just one of our leading our thought leaders in the whole e-discovery realm. And so it's great to see, it's refreshing to me to see somebody look at the way that we can do this, maybe change. Not that we necessarily automate it all the time, but maybe that we innovate it somehow. And, of course, that's not Judge Grimm's job. That's up to some of the vendors in the market.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so let's go into some of the EDRM steps. Identification. What's some of the things to think about in terms of shopping and when you're trying to identify your ESI?
Well, this is a hard one, only because identification can mean so many different things to so many people. You know, if you've read the Law Tech News, just had the latest thoughts from George Socha and Tom Geldman about the fact of their latest e-discovery survey that just came out. And they continue to talk about they are seeing a shift more to the left side of the EDRM, right? I mean, anytime that I go to a legal technology conference or just a legal conference in general where we're talking about e-discovery, no one ever talks about that first box way over on the left, right? Information management. And then, you get into identification. But that's just a black hole, at least from a legal perspective. I find that most people just don't want to talk about it. And, of course, for good reason, that could involve records management, records retention, document management, all the things, you know, there's information life cycles, enterprise content management, all this stuff that just kind of swirls around that information management. And, but as you start getting into that, the identification, I firmly believe that internally within a corporation, which is where we regularly see the identification, at least maybe more from a defense perspective, is that you have to have some tools in place to be able to literally and accurately identify where the data is stored. Now, a lot of times, I don't see much of a quantifiable aspect to the identification phase of EDRM. In fact, in my experience at least, most of the time, that's more of an internal investigation, if nothing else. And maybe if there is anything to quantify there, it's the time of an external consultant that may simply just come in and have a good idea of the questions to ask of maybe the email administrators, for example, or the network administrators. Where do people normally store data, for example? And then even maybe more importantly is to go to the individual custodians at their desk, if, as it were, face-to-face, and start asking them to try to get a better understanding of where do you store your data? How do you work with your data? Do you use Excel more than you use Word? And where do you save those documents, for example? Do you, one of the questions I routinely ask is, do you have the ability to save your own personal email archives? You know, if a company has a 30-day or a 90-day deletion period out off of their inbox, for example, it's important to know that just it's human nature that most people will say, oh my goodness, I'm going to have all this deleted immediately. Well, I've got to quickly make myself a little archive of all of the most important emails. Well, guess what? They'll save that as a PST file on their desktop, for example, or maybe their little space on the network share drive, for example. And that's important information to know, of course, because you have to know if information is living outside of the Exchange server, which maybe that's where the corporation thinks that all of the email is stored. And in fact, it turns out that there's other little places that you're going to have to find. So as I said, maybe the best quantifiable aspect there is maybe the time of an internal litigation investigation team or a response team, or maybe the cost of an external consultant to come in and help you create a plan as to say, what are the steps that we can take to try to identify the relevant ESI?
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to add to this, because I see this mistake made not infrequently, is this desire to make this easier than it is. Go out and get an enterprise system that can store everything and make it easier to manage. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good idea to try to get your arms around what you have. The problem is people that are trying to use these tools to solve their collection efforts. And there's no easy button. There's too many different types of data formats that are out there, and that the pace of change isn't slowing down. You get more and more web-based information that's out there.
That's right. That's right.
So the rigorous investigation that you've talked about, I think, is going to be very hard to get rid of, and if you don't, think if you're not aware of that, you might make some big mistakes with your enterprise system.
Well, Carl, it's a great point about there is no easy button. And, of course, that's what everybody wants. And most of the time that I work with lawyers, especially in-house attorneys, that may not have, they would admit this, they don't have a very good grasp of where all the data is stored necessarily in their company, which is why that they seek help both internally from their IT departments and externally with either consultants or even vendors to do that. Now, I will say for the identification, some of the tools, just real quick, and this will bleed over onto the collection phase as well. Some of the best tools, such as maybe Stored IQ, for example, or Autonomy has their idle infrastructure, and then Xero and some of the others, really what they're doing a lot of times is indexing, Carl. And, you know, everybody really wants to get a good handle on email, first and foremost. And so they may use a tool like Stored IQ to literally come in and to start an indexing aspect of their email, whether it's a live Exchange server or whether it's, you know, PST files that they've pulled off of the Exchange server and put on a SIP share somewhere that they just want to throw a tool out and to index it. So there is, like, there could be a quantifiable expense there in the indexing aspect, although, as you know, most tools such as the Stored IQ or even a Clearwell box, for example, or Autonomy, sometimes on this phase, on the left side of the EDRM, those tools are commonly brought in-house. So it's a premium price paid up front for an enterprise tool such as what you're talking about with Stored IQ or the Clearwell or an Autonomy tool. It's a premium price up front that they may have to pay, but then they own the system then that can really just do the indexing without like a per-click charge or anything else like that. So that could be one of the costs there. As I said, we're looking at least $500,000 a lot of times, three or four or five times that cost. But once they have that in-house, and many of the companies that have implemented a system like that have gone on to say, well, it saved us several million dollars over the course of the next 3 or 4 years, because we had this in-house to better get a handle and identify that information, collect it, and then filter it down as we go into the processing stage. Better filter it down before we give it over to our outside counsel, our outside law firms, to do their substantive review.
Yep. We did move into the collection stage as well here, which is great. You want to add anything else to collection, or I think pretty much.
I think that would be mostly it if we're specifically talking about the e-discovery services here. The other thing I would say on collection, though, is something that Jurinov does very well, as many other vendors across the country, is the forensic imaging aspect of that. A lot of times, that is a very quantifiable metric that you can use of either perhaps per hard drive, for example. You know, how much do people charge per hard drive to do a forensic image of that hard drive? You know, that is a form of collection, as well as preservation, obviously. Sometimes there will be an additional hourly charge, of course, for a professional forensic examiner to go in there and to spend their time, whether during the day or the night. And a lot of times what I see people don't take advantage of is that companies like Jurinov and many others across the country, to utilize the expertise of that forensic image so that you can go through and you can get a report, you know, whether it's NCASE or FTK or something along those lines, is that a report can be generated from those images so that you can quickly look at and see, for example, are there any PST files on here? And if yes, on this hard drive, how big are they? You know, that could give you a good clue as to whether somebody has saved it or what are the file names of those PST files. It's a good way to get an idea of how many Word documents are on a personal computer. Or you can, of course, do a forensic image on a server or even a cell phone or a smartphone these days. So certainly when it comes to the collection aspect, those are costs or expenses that you can do. Some people will go to the extreme of saying, why not collect first and then you can look through it later, or you can call it down later. And so, in other words, it could be cheaper theoretically to go through and to image all 25 computers necessarily. Then you have the images there, and then you can work with it later on when the cost is better. Or some people will say that's not necessary off at the front end. Perhaps that you can do a little bit more collection from an Exchange server, for example, but then you can decide later on if you need to do those forensic images.
Yep, there's all sorts of ways to slice it. Let's talk a little bit about processing and hosting.
Well, this is really starting to get into the major areas, or I would maybe say the historical areas, mm-hmm. where there has been a quantifiable cost associated with electronic discovery, first litigation support in general, and then nowadays, of course, with e-discovery. And I guess what I mean by that there is we've sort of always had a processing charge when we have done electronic litigation support. And I'm talking now about more like summation, for example, right?
Yep.
And concordance and some of the older tools that have been around for many years and have done a very good job and continue to do a great job for many law firms, by the way. But Summation, even though they do have some very good e-discovery tools, I remember the first time that they came out with their email loader, for example, where you could just take a PST file, and wasn't the greatest, but it did work. But Summation and Concordance are still tools that, even though they have improvements, they still work the best when you have really TIFF images. You know, and I still like to use the single page TIFF images, especially if we're going to be going into trial work later on. But they work best with the TIFF images. They'll take Word documents and native PDFs. But if you're looking for speed, for example, a lot of times TIFF images always work best. So those processing costs have always been literally taking pieces of paper and scanning them. So we've always historically had a per-page scanning cost, which we've all seen come down to next to nothing, you know, 6 or 5 cents per page these days now. Then there has always been a per document coding cost associated with that, and then a lot of times a per document OCR cost. You know, those type of things as we go through. So I believe, at least in the litigation world, if we've used anything like summation and concordance before, you're already used to some kind of a, you know, per unit cost of some kind on that. And I don't think that's changed just a whole lot when we come and talk about electronic discovery. We, all the major tools out there still have a way to TIFF images for various reasons, most notably redactions and base numbers and eventually for production. But even some of the tools that will host native information or native documents will still have the option to TIFF those files. So, for various reasons. Sometimes people will just want to bring them into summation. Whenever you have that TIFFing cost, we still see that per page cost on creating that TIFF image. Which I would just say, by the way, it's a quick little soapbox of mine here. It still blows me away. I mean, I understand why we have that necessity to convert electronic files into per page, but it's becoming less and less necessary these days. I mean, it's not going to go away. I realize that we're still going to be around and we don't like the paperless, but, you know, I always tell people the only reason there is a print layout button within Microsoft Word is because Microsoft knows that you're going to eventually hit the print button. Because in reality, to Microsoft Word, you know, you have the draft view, for example. There is no pages within a Microsoft Word document, just like there's really no pages within a website, for example, or even an email. If you have 15 replies and forwards, you know, in the body of an email, there are no pages there until you hit the print button. And so I think this is what we're getting to here as we talk about, and I know you have a couple of comments on this, you know, we could still quantify an electronic file in the manner of a page, but it's getting more and more ridiculous. And the last point that I'll make here, Craig Ball a couple of years ago wrote an excellent article that I still refer people to. It's literally called Exploding the Page Equivalency Myth. You know, because people will say, how many pages does a gigabyte have? And you'll hear anything from 15,000 pages to 500 million pages. And I remember that Craig's comment in that article, which is on law.com now, is that he doesn't know what surprises him more, the fact that there's such a crazy spectrum of the number of pages that will be inside a gigabyte, or the fact that lawyers and judges just accept it blindly without even really asking. You know, he says these are the same people that won't concede that the sky is blue without a supporting string citation, but yet they'll just accept that, oh, okay, well, that's 75,000, so we'll use that as our metric and we'll plug that in as the price.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, with a lot of the web-based services now, and there's been more of a movement to actually try to do more review in native and not TIFF right away until later in the process, so that you at least cut down on that cost. And, you know, the thought about taking a document, as you say, that's already in electronic format that has a lot of data that you can work with, and turning it into a page.
That's right.
It seems a little silly when you think about it.
Well, and I think I would say just real quick, that's one quick argument for some of those early case assessment tools, if you want to call it that. There's so many phrases that fly around. But the fact that they are indexing live data and they basically just use that index to allow you to search, for example, before you go into the collection of the preservation aspect of it, some of that can be very helpful because you're not having to do that upfront TIFFing cost on there.
So then the primary analysis measurement that comes out of this area is cost per gigabyte to hold on to this data,
right?
And the charges in that area. Do you think we're at a commodity level yet at this point where it makes a lot of sense just to pick a platform based on cost per gigabyte?
Well, that's a great question. It's always been per gigabyte, and it will continue to be per gigabyte because, again, I think that that's the best quantifiable aspect that we can come up with so far if we are going to be charging for that. And, you know, I don't want to point fingers at a vendor, for example. I might point a little bit more of a finger at the lawyers. not because they're directly responsible for it, but I just believe that most lawyers have a harder time understanding that when they ask for a cost or when they ask for an estimate of how much is this going to cost, okay, we say we have 20 gigs of email, how much is it going to cost? Why can't you just tell me, Mr. or Mrs. Bender, why can't you just tell me how much this is going to cost? Well, it depends. What kind of data do you have? And that's the point that Craig Ball makes in his comment. It all in his article. It all depends on the type of data that you have. Is that 20 gigabytes of email? Well, yeah, it's just email. It's just we took off. Well, does any of the emails have attachments? Of course they have attachments on there. Well, what kind of attachments? Are we talking about, 2 kilobyte text files? Are we talking about 5 gigabyte PDF files or zip files, for example, which is always the horror story of having a compressed file of some kind.
Yeah.
And so, but lawyers will still insist, Carl, on having some kind of an estimate. And I'm not saying that's a wrong thing, because then the client, of course, is insisting on that as well. You have to have some kind of estimate. But in order to get to that estimate, this is my major complaint, you have to break it down and kind of adulterate that native file collection into something that can be quantifiable. And that's why we see we have to have something to measure how many pages per gigabyte are we going to use. Because if we don't have some kind of a standard or an assumption there, then we're just pulling numbers out of thin air. And so it's unfortunate that we do have to come down and say, okay, well, we're going to assume then for the purposes of this particular RFP or response or the estimate, that there's 60,000 pages to a gigabyte. And then if you have that assumption, then you can start breaking it down to try to give some kind of a semi-accurate estimate. But as we all know, that's one of the major complaints a lot of times from lawyers about the e-discovery vendors, is that it always balloons up. It always blossoms into twice the cost that they originally estimated for. Doesn't make the clients happy, and in turn, of course, doesn't make the lawyers happy. But how else are you going to do it? I think about this, and one of the ways that I liken this is people will continue to insist in the legal industry to, I guess, equivalate, is that a word? They will equivalate emails and Word documents and Excel spreadsheets into pieces of paper, mainly because maybe that's what we're most comfortable with, or that's the only thing that we can quantify anything on. But one of the closest analogies I can think of is, that's like trying to say how many miles to the gallon can an electric car run. If you have a total electric car, there is no gallons of gasoline, right? We're talking about a battery there that runs. But people will still insist. I mean, I know there was a story not too long ago with Chevrolet has their new Volt, which I believe is their new electric car. And of course, everybody clicked on this headline. I did, because they said, we estimate this will get 230 miles to the gallon in the city. Well, who doesn't want a car that gets 230 miles to the gallon? Well, it turns out it's an electric car. So how do you quantify that? I try to use this to help people along in the fact of you can't always put a per-page aspect onto a native electronic file. I mean, I understand that we have to a lot of times because that's the only way we could get a price. But I do see that more people or some vendors are starting to come up with a little more innovative ways to price out e-discovery projects without having to stoop down to that argument about how many pages in a gigabyte and then basing their cost on that.
Yep, and the only thing I'll add, and we'll go into review, is if there's been a flurry of activity this year already with new processes coming out to basically make review less expensive, and
right.
Hone down process so that it's defensible and you know what you're doing, and it's intelligently thought through. And you may pay a little bit more for the types of tools that are going to help you to spend less review time. And if it substantially cuts down on review time, well, heck, then it was a good investment. So let's talk about review.
Okay. Again, as we mentioned at the top of the show, historically this has always been the biggest expense. And as I mentioned, my friend Tom O'Connor, he still believes, as with many other people, I should add, that it's really because we just can't get away from that hourly billable fee. And that just goes to the comment you just made there, Carl. There are tools out there that will claim, and I think even more accurately today, their claims are becoming more accurate, in that they can provide a better initial culling, an initial filtering, as it were, or maybe even sometimes an initial grouping. You know, one of the big tools I always think about in this area is a 10X, for example. Not necessarily because of the accuracy all the time. I don't want to speak to that necessarily, but because of the visual that they give you. And it literally is, here are circles, and each circle represents a concept, if you will, or a topic that these documents or these emails are discussing. That can be very helpful. The major hurdle to that, a lot of times, at least I found, is just the comfort level from attorneys, law firms that I've worked with. They just don't trust it, is really what it comes down to. That's the computer making those decisions, and a lot of people just don't trust that. Now, other people that I have worked with that do kind of get it, and I'm using my bunny air quotes here, if a lawyer actually gets what something like a 10X is doing, or even Intelligis or some of these other visual analytical tools, then it's Katie bar the door. They just go nuts on it. I mean, they trust it inherently. They are very comfortable with it, and it turns out that they cut down their review time, of course, by leaps and bounds, maybe cutting it down even by 60-75%, because they know that after those tools do their work, and it's a lot of mathematical algorithms showing how words and phrases and how close they are together, and they cluster these documents together, they can just wholesale shove out some of these irrelevant data groups immediately, and then they know that the lawyer then will just hone in on exactly what they need from a substantive aspect, as opposed to just going through each document one by one.
Yeah, I come from both camps. I mean, I'm on the technology side, and I have a long career on the review side, and I don't think you're ever going to completely get rid of review because of the thinking that needs to be done. The vetting, the quality assurance, just to make sure that you're comfortable with what you're seeing, based on, you know, what the machines are saying you should maybe be focusing on. However, you know, I do believe very strongly in the theory of John Henry, and I'm thinking about doing a podcast just reading John Henry. The story of John Henry.
I like it.
Because, you know, I mean, it's scalable and it's a lot less expensive and you can get things done quicker, and there's all sorts of studies going on in this area showing that machines are no worse than people. So anyway, I think there's going to be a lot happening in this space, and probably subject for more and more podcasts.
I like that. It's funny because I'm looking up right now. I did a blog post called John Henry, He Was an ESI Driving Man. And sure enough, it talks to, I think there was a Wall Street Journal article that was, hammers out some of the tension between automated e-discovery tools and the hesitancy of lawyers and law firms to embrace the machine.
Oh, and I thought I had something novel here. There is no novel in e-discovery. Oh, well.
I'm telling you because I want you to take that and you can use some of the links that I have here. Okay. Because it's right. It's that constant give and take. You know, in this law.com article that I wrote, I believe I called it "Subdue the Cost of Document Review." One of the things that I did address was Ann Kershaw and her group. I think it's the eDiscovery
Institute.
Thank you. I think this was back in 2005, so it's a little older now. But some of the numbers are in the article there, where they were doing, they literally had a group, I might have been the Enron collection of emails, I'm not sure, but they took this small, you know, control group of documents, had the humans do it, the puny humans had to review this one site, and then they used some automated technology, I think it was from H5, for example, that they used. And it turns out that I think the human review was about 51% accurate, whereas the automated review was 90% accurate. And the conclusion of their study basically said, well, it's because humans, as human nature, just get distracted. It's not because we're not good at recognizing that. But, you know, there always is that little give and take, if you will, or that little margin of error between reviewers. If you have a collection of reviewers, somebody might say that's relevant, and the next person next to them may say it's not. You always have that little margin of error, which, of course, I believe can best be controlled by a good project manager and a good review manual. But in a document review aspect like that, you also have people that are thinking about lunch and they're thinking about the next job that they want to go to, because they may be just be a contract attorney, for example, and they're, you know, surfing the web and listening to music, whatever the case may be. There's all sorts of human error aspects in there. Now, I know Anne and her group, I think they're getting ready to release another study here coming up fairly soon, but I just thought that that was always very interesting. It doesn't go anywhere. That doesn't really get any traction to any lawyers that I talk to about that, but it is extremely interesting to have that one study at least.
Yep, Herb Roy-Blatt's involved in that. He's
done a
study, and he did a podcast on concept searching here, and that's coming out. It's very soon. It was a scientific study, and I think it's going to open up some eyes.
Well, there's one other comment I wanted to make, Carl, on the review aspect, just because I addressed this in my article as well, and that is there have been some vendors that have done a little bit of experimentation on this, and I want to make the listeners to be aware of this. For example, back in Legal Tech 2008, Huron Consulting had a nifty press release for their solution called Velocity. You may have seen this. Instead of an E, it's a 3 in the word Velocity. But the biggest splash that they made at that time was they claimed we can do e-discovery processing and review and production for you for 25 cents a page. And that's when they came out. Now, I think most of us from the e-discovery industry, we're looking at that, well, I don't know if that really works out. And it turns out that it works out. They are very competitive in what they do, and I know that they do very, very good work. It's not to say anything against the substantive work that they do. But the biggest splash to me was just a marketing aspect, because when you look at the numbers, and all of us have done pricing on e-discovery projects before, 25 cents per page is really not that different than most of the other vendors out there. As I said, Huron, I believe, is a little more competitive. The biggest thing, though, Carl, is that when Huron can go into a group or a room of lawyers that are, you know, have so much other work to do and they just want to get this e-discovery project out of the way, 25 cents per page, number one, sounds fantastic, and number two, it's predictable. And to me, and so I followed up with one of the VPs of Huron for my article, and I talked to them a little bit about that. And one of the comments that he made to me was most of their clients, which happens to be a lot of large corporate clients, they kept insisting on cost predictability more so than simply cost reduction. And that was just a theme that he hammered home to me as we were having our discussion. And that really stuck with me, because I think that's what more people are looking for, is more of the predictable aspect of the cost, as opposed to, you know, going halfway and then all of a sudden it says, well, we found that we had 50 gig worth of zip files, and that turns out that it blows up into 250 gigs worth. So, whatever we said, you better multiply that times 3, and that's what the cost is going to be at the end of the day. And they were just talking about how most people just are not comfortable with that. One of the other vendors I talked with was Discover Ready. And they don't necessarily do a per-page cost, but they are very insistent on more of a per-unit cost, whether that's maybe a per-document cost. And to me, I like that approach just a little bit better, because I think it gets more to – it has a little more flexibility as far as a per document. I think of a lot of times as really just per file, right, as opposed to a per page, which really insists that you have to go to a TIFF, you have to process it into TIFF.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a per document cost, that could help out a little bit better or kind of lean more toward a native review, which I think can be helpful. Anyway, the last comment I'll make on both of those vendors, Huron and Discover Ready, I kept asking them, but what about those problems? Projects like I just mentioned to you have a bunch of zip files. You don't expect that because you did not get that kind of information from the client, for example. Both vendors told me that they will sometimes run into problem projects like that, but based on their experience, and that's really what it came down to, as simple as that, either because they've worked with that client before and so they know what kind of data that they're going to be getting from that client, or they have just done similar type projects before. So if it's an employment case, they kind of know generally what kind of documents, or if it's a medical malpractice case, they generally know what kind of documents to be expecting, for example. And so both of them were very comfortable using that, either the per-page pricing or the per-document pricing, or just the general per-unit pricing based on the experience. And I think, again, that goes back all the way to the left side of the DRM, is bringing somebody in, maybe even at the initial stage of identification and collection, to help you identify properly and accurately what kind of data that you're going to be collecting.
Okay, and well, the last stage is what we talked a bit about, production, about getting it through. If you need to do another file conversion, that could be another cost factor.
Right.
You know, what are your risk assessments? You think that that's something people should be doing more of?
I think so. You know, to me, the risk assessments really come up a little bit more when you are doing some of the e-discovery work in-house, when you're either bringing in a processing machine to do that for you, or some software to do processing inside, whether you're a corporation or a law firm. And then the risk assessments are important there, even in the review aspect. Should you be hosting this information? Should a law firm be doing the collection of data from a client? You know, there's arguments on both sides. We don't necessarily have to get into there. But the more of the e-discovery, the EDRM that you bring in-house, I believe that you should be doing more of a risk assessment on each of those phases. Should you really be responsible? Should a law firm really have the responsibility of doing the conversion aspect? I'm not saying that they can't do it. And I would think every law firm has either, you know, law pre-discovery or the old Z-print or one of the iPro products, eScanit or Premium Scan. They can certainly do the processing themselves internally. But number one, do you want to take on that cost? Number two, do you have the resources to do it? And then lastly, do you trust somebody to do that internally at the firm? Because, yeah, it may be a little more expensive to go out to a vendor. But if that vendor, if that's what the vendor does, that which means that they should be more of an expert and they have a lot more experience in doing that, maybe that's the better place to go.
Yeah, and there's in addition to maybe having more tools and experience, e-discovery is not like a balance sheet in an accounting sort of world
where you
can basically say this is it at this point in time. If you make that investment, and you buy whatever tools you want to get into hosting or something like that, your law firm and you know, people can do these sort of different things. You got to look 2 years out. Is the technology going to be the same?
That's right.
Are you going to have the current tech people maybe you have, or are they going to want to be like Brett Burney and leave the firm and open up their own consulting shop? Then where are you?
That's right.
I mean, these are, you know, especially given the fact that e-discovery isn't something that we've nailed down yet and you know, had the golden process that everyone's agreed on.
The easy button.
The easy button's not there yet, although we're all working on it.
We are, and I have to say, I'm encouraged with the trends in e-discovery. You know, like I said, the latest Social Gelbman. Well, you can buy the full survey, right? But they do a fantastic little article on law technology news that you can read. I was encouraged by that. You know, we're still in a very important aspect of the e-discovery industry, as I call it, which I guess would sort of hint a little bit more towards that commoditization aspect if you're talking about it, the industrialization of e-discovery, if you will. That's a good book or an article you can write if I don't blog it first.
Okay.
But the idea is that there are some very innovative aspects happening in e-discovery. You know, as you already mentioned, some of the online review tools that are coming out. You know, every day this week is ILTA, so we are getting a lot more press releases from some of the vendors out there. But they're coming up with different ways to do this, maybe some different ways to either sample the data, is what we used to call it, sampling the data. Nowadays, maybe it's sort of just getting a quick peek into it, or what we call the early case assessment, using tools maybe like StoredIQ or Clearwell or Xero or some of these other tools to literally just get kind of a peek into that data, get an idea of how much is there, do maybe a little bit, or one backup tape or one PST file from a custodian. It's important, though, that when I mention that, most of that would be with the help of outside vendors. Do you want to have that overhead internally at a law firm or a corporation? You know, most of the time law firms, you've mentioned this before, they already have summation in-house, which is fantastic. Maybe they've had it for many years. But it's not cheap to bring summation in. It's a good value. I don't mean it that way, but it's not just the software, right? You have to take into account the servers that it should run on, unless you want maybe just a workstation license. But then there's the storage aspects and the fact that the networking aspects have to come in if you want to share it with other people. And then not to mention the fact, the time and resources of the people that will be supporting an application like Summation or Clearwell or whatever it is. There are backups that need to be made, and there's maintenance that needs to be done on that, and upgrades and cost of the maintenance on the license. And then you need to have help desk and support time like that. You know, and I'm encouraged to see a lot more of sort of whatever you want to call it, the software as a service, or these online offerings that will take on some of that load and take those risks and to take the burden off of the practitioners, them being the lawyers, for example, or the law firms.
Yep. This is comes right back to our project management podcast, huh?
Yes, it sure does. You know, and as I was looking through this and thinking about this podcast, Carl, I kept coming back to that. You know, it just as we talked about on our podcast, it's important to understand project management in the terms of a professional discipline, as opposed to just like, oh yeah, I manage this. You know, I manage my day every day. I look at my calendar. I manage all these projects. Well, it's not quite that simple. And actually, I just wrote a techno feature for TechnoLawyer that should be coming out this week on project management, banking off some of the work that you and I did on our podcast, Carl. It's really establishing those goals and objectives at each stage in either the EDRM or just in the project overall. It's not enough to say our goal on this project is to get the best possible resolution for our client. Well, at the high level, yes, it is. But when we're talking about e-discovery these days and some of the aspects that can be commoditized or can be quantifiable, it's really important to start breaking that down. And a project manager that at least has been trained or is aware of the professional techniques or the technicalities of project management can help establish those goals and those objectives along the way. So, okay, here's the review. When do we need it to be done? And here is the cost that we need to play into it. It's that project management triangle between the scope of the project, the cost, and the time. And you have to balance all of that out, and you have to do it so that both your clients are happy, whether that's the law firm or the corporate entity.
Well, Brett, I think we've covered a lot of ground here, and I'm going to mention one last thing. I'm going to do a follow-up on project management. I've got a lawyer or lit support person at a big law firm that has agreed to do the podcast, and I'm talking to an in-house lawyer, and I might cover the technology, and we'll bring sort of the three different stakeholders into project management, but it'll be a follow-up to the one that we did, Brett. And with that in mind, go ahead.
One more comment, if you don't mind, Carl. I don't want to leave without mentioning this because I know a lot of people may have been looking for an easy button as they listen to this on the cost and everything. And as you can see from this podcast, it's very elusive, right? It always depends. But one thing that I like that a couple of vendors have done, Orange Legal Technologies has an online e-discovery calculator, but Juranov actually has, I think, a little bit better of a calculator. You guys have gone in and kind of done it at a little more granular level. And I would just invite people to go and explore that. If anybody's familiar with e-discovery and litigation support, it'll be very intuitive to use to plug in some of the information. Now, this is getting back to that commoditization, I believe, a little bit more, because, again, you're making the assumption about how many pages per gigabyte. But I would just want to point that out. There are a couple of more calculators out there. I can't think of any right now, but Orange Legal Technologies and Juranov, you have a link right from Juranov's homepage.
Yeah.
That you can go in there and do that e-discovery calculator. If nothing else, while it's not going to be dispositive for individual projects, it can at least give people an idea. It could give a general idea of some of what they're looking for. You know, the biggest danger for me is anytime I work with a client, especially at a law firm, they're always going to be looking for the cost. How much is this going to cost? And I understand that. I go in fully aware of that. But my biggest problem is that I have to always say, at least to make myself feel better, I'm going to give you a cost based on these assumptions. And that assumption being this many pages per gigabyte, right? And we're going to assume that the reviewers can get through, you know, let's say 65 documents per hour, you know, which could be close upwards of 500 a day type of a thing. So if we have five reviewers, you know, on and on and on, right? You have to go in with those set of assumptions in order to try to be accurate or at least to give a good, well-rounded estimate. And some of that has to be done when you go into those e-discovery calculators. But I guess right now it's better than nothing. I mean, it's the best that we have to try to quantify some of the work that we do on the e-discovery realm until we can get – we can – I guess, evolve more into with a comfort level with working with native files so that we don't have this idea of the pages and we can just get concentrate more on the native data, on data as it is data, as opposed to trying to plug it into an actual physical piece of paper every time.
Yeah, and I think that was a good way to end it, and that looking at a calculator, and I'll just make one point about the Jurnov calculator, being somewhat familiar with that. It will teach you, if you haven't really thought through your project very well, because ask you for information, and if you don't have it, well, then you're going to have a hard time figuring out what your project's going to cost, and you should be thinking a little bit more. You know, that right there can say maybe you have a couple of issues. You're not sure what you're getting into.
Good point.
But thanks again for you know, attempting to tackle the almost impossible topic of how to price out e-discovery. And for a full list of podcasts, I'd invite the listeners to go to www.esibytes.com. You can use our scroll bar to find podcasts by speakers or topics within the EDR model. Feel free to visit ESI Bytes to learn about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again, and have a nice day.